Welcome to Worlds Apart. For years, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict seemed to be the most irreconcilable discord in international relations, but now this grim title is being claimed by the war in Ukraine, which, unlike the Middle Eastern strife, hasn't yet seen any meaningful mediation effort. Which one is harder to resolve at this point? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Gabi Siboni, senior researcher at the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security. Mr. Siboni, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for
your time.
Now, before you became a war scholar, I know that you served as an infantry officer for the Israeli army, and you took part in both Lebanon wars, which some members of the international community condemned as illegal or as wars of aggression. And I wonder, what was it like for you on a personal basis to partake in conflicts that others described as barbaric?
Well, you know, in Israel, we are always described as doing illegal activity. It doesn't matter if we do anything illegal. Both wars were self-defense wars, and we had to respond to severe attacks of terrorists from the northern border, from Lebanon. Mind you, there are not only two wars, because I participate also in the Litani operation, which was a third one. So Lebanon has been for years instability place, and that continuously was harassing the northern population of Israel. And from time to time, we had to react.
Now, it's not only about what others say. I think it's also about the so-called international law, because the UN General Assembly condemned Israel's actions.
The General Assembly does not specify the international law. The international law is very well specified. And Israel has always been conducting all its military operations within the constraints of international law.
Well, within constraints of international law, but extraterritorially. And you understand the paradox there.
I would argue that, because I've beside the fact that I practice it in person, I researched this issue for many years. And together with in the International Committee of the Red Cross in Israel, their office in Israel, And I have to tell you that Israel is one of the most responsible states taking care of international law, and is very, very careful in trying to prevent civilian losses, non-involved civilian losses.
Mr. Siboni, I'm sure you would agree with me that every state existing on this planet would claim the same, including the Americans, including the Russians, including the Chinese. So I want to ask you specifically about Israel. How do you think it balances the constraints, imposed by international law, versus the prerogatives of its own security, which sometimes run counter to legal
agreements? First of all, I want to challenge your first statement that every country will say the same. It's not a matter of saying, it's a matter of facts on the ground. Because I have seen how, for example, the Americans have behaved in Iraq, how the Russians have behaved in other places in the world.
Like in the
80s in Afghanistan.
And those were the Soviets.
I break the line. Yes, anyway, in all the conflicts, also in Georgia, it was Russia. Yes, in Georgia. Yes, in Chechnya, and. And I've seen, and not only Russia, it's not only Russia, because Israel is practically writing the international law with its very, very careful conduct in fighting in complex areas, in high populated, very populated areas.
Well, Mr. Siboni, if you can allow me also a little bit of self-revelation, I have many Arab friends who are very critical, as you can imagine, of Israel's actions. And one of my friends told me that it's easier for me, the Russian, to get a visa to Israel than for him, even though his family lived there for generations. So I think we can at least agree that Israel's actions have also been criticized on human rights grounds.
Regarding visa to Israel?
Not only visa, but also access to certain ancestral lands, the treatment of civilians on the ground, freedoms allowed to them.
I want to tell you something. Hamas, for example, which is a Palestinian terror organization, the strategy of Hamas is to fire missiles towards civilian population in Israel, kindergarten, schools, whatever, from civilian population as a protective shield. So they use their own civilian population. It's not a secret. I've written about it for many times. For example, they've been firing missiles from the vicinity of UNRWA, the UN Palestinian refugee organization, from the vicinity of UNRWA, from schools. And why do they do that? Just for one reason, to protect themselves, because they know that Israel will not fire back to a place where there is a school or there is a, you know, highly chances that non-involved will be harmed. So even if Israel is firing to destroy, let's say, Hamas headquarters, we normally warn the people inside that headquarters that we are going to bomb. And we warn them either we lift it, either with phone calls, and there are evidences of such phone calls. And if those two do not work, we also use some inertic charges that does not only make sound, to make sure that the population in the house is evacuated before we destroy it. So I think these claims about Israel, I know them. Of course, I know them, they exist, but they are completely unjustified.
Now, as I'm sure you know, Russia has been very careful, long before the current conflict in Ukraine, has been very careful about its criticism of Israel, and I think also very understanding of Israel's security sensibilities, understanding that the realities on the ground may differ from some abstract values. And at the same time, it maintained a working relationship with the Palestinians, with the Iranians, with other actors in the region. How do you understand Moscow's stance vis-a-vis your country, especially on security matters?
Yes. First of all, I think that Russia has a very important role because they have very strong ties with Israel. And in fact, the Soviet immigration to Israel and later the Russian immigration to Israel has contributed very much to the Israel economy and to Israel scientific, because the education, the Russian education.
Well, the same happened
Soviet
to Ukraine,
education.
But we don't enjoy the same security relationship,
let's say,
unfortunately.
I very much appreciate, I don't know what happens with the Russian education, but I very much appreciate the Soviet education, scientific education, and Israel have benefited from
it. It's interesting
from
to hear that. Thank you.
Yes. And so this is the side of Israel. And also, Russia is important because it has very good relations with our enemies, with the enemies. The Palestinian people are not the enemies, but there are organizations like Hamas, like Islamic Jihad, that are our enemies. Or the Syrians were our enemies, and still they are our enemies. They declare the Iranians are our enemies. So they have good relations with these countries, and it's very important to have this kind of relations with an entity that can make some terms with those countries, because that's very important. Russia is also, as you know, involved in Syria very much, and we are active in Syria. Israel is very active in trying to avoid Iran to get a foothold in Syria. And Israel is attacking Iranian and also Syrian when they jeopardize very much our security infrastructure in Syria. We are coordinating those attacks with the Russians.
What do you think made it possible? Because I'm sure you understand the context in which this interview is taking place. We have a war in a neighboring country with, what we used to refer to as a brotherly nation before. And yet what you are telling me is that the Russians are actually, when it comes to the battlefields, Russians can operate with the degree of reasonableness. Why do you think that kind of cooperation that is possible in Syria between the Israelis, The Iranians, even the Americans are there.
There is no cooperation between Israel and Iran.
Yeah,
in
but
Syria.
Mediating, like interlinking the two.
No, there is, just to make sure that I was clearly understood, there is cooperation, operational cooperation, tactical operation cooperation between Israel and Russia, well, while Israel is attacking Iran.
Absolutely, but all sides engage in this cooperation, understanding their own practical interests. They continue being maybe enemies at some point or competitors at another, but they pursue it with, this, with certain norms. Why was it possible in Syria, and why do you think it wasn't possible, let's say, when it comes to Ukraine?
Well, I will talk about Ukraine in a second. I just want to specify my point regarding Syria or the Iranians in Syria. Iranians, they are active very harshly against Israel. They operate a huge terror campaign because they have a strategy of, let's say, they want to gain hegemony in the Middle East. So Israel is, for them, the little Satan, and the big one is America, of course.
And Russia is balancing it out. I mean,
I don't know if Russia is balancing out. I know that Iranian is very heavy involved inside Israel with Arab Israelis, with the Palestinian terror organization, helping them and promoting them and funding them in doing terror attacks in Israel. This is the fact.
As I'm sure the Israeli intelligence
Israel is not doing terror attacks in Iran.
Seriously, come
on. Seriously, not doing terror attacks in Iran.
The world tends to think
you know what's other. Terror? It's trying to kill innocent people with no discrimination. But Israel is not, never have done that.
I think it's fair to admit that, you know, each country engages itself in covert operations, and that's beside
covert
the
operation
point.
Is okay.
I'm not here.
Covert operations are okay.
Well,
we do
including
that.
Nuclear facilities, for example.
Absolutely, absolutely. Covert operation, as
which can
say,
harm a lot of people.
No. Covert as we say, in because we are censored in Israel, so you as written in foreign press, that Israel was active in, is active in Iran, but is not doing terror activity in Iran, is not harming civilians in Iran indiscriminately, while Iran is doing that very heavily in Israel.
Can I repeat my original question is, why do you think that kind of operational rivalry versus cooperation that was possible in Syria, where Russia is functioning as a go-between, at least, let's say, between Israel and its enemies, why do you think that model wasn't possible in Ukraine? Why does Ukraine have to be, you know, somebody else's, somebody's trophy, rather than being a field
think,
where everybody plays?
Our former government, I think our former, before Netanyahu, we had a short time of 1 year of government, which the former prime minister thought that he would be able to get some terms between Russia and Ukraine in the beginning. It was a bit, in my view, pathetic, but this is a battle between huge entities. Israel is a small country, you know. We barely have energy to take care of our problems. But I think that, first of all, I want to tell you personally that the war between, I saw it coming. I understood it was coming. And, you know, one has to understand the sense of self-defense that Russia had in regard to the activity of Ukraine and mainly the activity of NATO in the eastern side of NATO.
Can I stop you for a moment? Because this is a hugely important question and we have to take a short break, but we will expand on it just after it. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Gabi Siboni, senior researcher at the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security. Mr. Siboni, before I interrupted you, you started talking about self-defense, and self-defense is indeed something that Israel claims on many occasions, and something that Russia also invoked to justify its military operation in Ukraine. Do you think it's a legitimate
Self-defense ground? Is part of the UN decree, you know, that
you're but allowed. But it's in another country's territory.
You're allowed to react on self-defense if you are attacked, your self-defense. I mentioned that Russia, I did not say that it reacted as self-defense. I said that it was, and my understanding was that Russia is acting under the sense of self-defense. Imagine that Russian troops are deployed on the border between Mexico and the United States. What
or in
will
Cuba.
The United States do? What will the United States do in this scenario? I'm sure that the United States will not tolerate such.
Can I ask you, as a conflict scholar, because this tension between Russia and NATO, Russia and the West, had been boiling for many years prior to 2022. It was in a proxy form. Cyber attacks, military drills, chemical labs, what have you, diplomatic strife, but it wasn't kinetic. What do you think allowed for this sort of under the carpet conflict to become fully expressed war on the battlefield?
First, it was an initiative of your government, of the Russian government. The Russian government has started
this. But how do you understand it as an observer?
You have to understand that, first of all, before the hostility began, the kinetic hostility began, there was some active, hostilities in other means. You know that now with the information era, what we call information campaigns or influence campaigns.
We call it InfoWars, actually.
InfoWars have been active very much. And I don't know if it's a compliment or not, but Russia is very, very well known, at least in my milieu, that Russia is well known for its ability to conduct this kind of operations.
Seriously?
Yes. Also in Israel, mind you. I know that Russia is active all over the world, in Europe, even now.
What do you actually mean by that? Because I've been working for this channel, which has been described as a propaganda bullhorn. I've been working here for 15 years, but I try to do honest analysis with the thought that we actually live on the same planet. And if it's comes up in a nuclear mushroom, nobody will benefit.
Look, first of all, Russia is not the only one that conducts influence operation. Every state, responsible state, will use this technology.
But there's a difference between influence operation, which is honest, authentic propagation of your views, and InfoWars.
Is it the same? No. Influence operation is not honest of your views. Your views is okay, but influence operation is trying to affect how people, for example, in Germany, or in Poland, or in the Baltics, think and act. Using what we call influence tools or fake news or whatever you want to use to convince them or to polarize discourse or to create instability.
I don't see Russia using, to be honest with you, I don't see Russia using too much fake news. I mean, like, we had that term popularized during the Trump administration.
To be honest, I don't know what is truth anymore, not because of Russia. I don't know what's truth anymore. Only God knows what is true. We are now facing, when I read something, I don't know. I believe nothing what I read, whatever. Only my mind, and sometimes my mind is manipulated by others, and I don't know that it has been manipulated. Truth is not a factor anymore. You don't know what is truth.
Well,
so everybody is using the best way to get their goals, be it true, be it non-true. Nobody knows.
Now, the Americans like to say that a perception is reality, and this is actually one of the ways they used to impose their worldview onto the rest of the world. And I think one of the reasons why the Russians launched their military operation in Ukraine is to prove that reality is reality. And if your security interests are threatened, you have to respond not just by words, but by actions. Do you think Russia will succeed in that?
I researched influence operation during the Ukraine-Russian war, at least during the first year, and to try to understand what's going on. The Ukrainians are also active very much in this field. Everybody is active. So this is a part of war now. It's become a part of war. You don't use only kinetics, you use also
Can
this
you
kind of
win
tools.
A war through influence operations
Please?
Only? Can you win a conflict through influence operations
I'm sorry,
only?
So in my view, to the to the foreseen future without shooting bullets and without getting your mud on your boots, there is no way to win any war.
Now, I drew some parallels between the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the war in Ukraine. And I think one major difference is that whenever the Israeli-Palestinian strife goes kinetic, there are always efforts to mediate, or at least there are calls for a ceasefire. But in the case of Ukraine, we haven't seen any meaningful effort. You mentioned the statements by former Israeli government. There have been some utterings in other capitals, but nobody gave it a real hard effort. Why not? Or why not yet?
Well, I think that Russia and Ukraine did not reach Ukraine. Ukraine is not alone because Ukraine is somehow operated slash manipulated by Americans or by Western countries, and the demands of Ukraine or Zelensky are not acceptable by Russia. It does not match. They want to redraw to the borders of 1991 or something like that. I don't know, and it does not match. So as long as they stay on those two polar points, it will not, and it doesn't matter if you bring Netanyahu to the table or you bring someone else to the table trying to get terms between the sides. It has to be, I've read recently, just in the last days, that there is a reduction in European, population support to continue supporting Ukraine. And there is a reduction in American support to continue supporting Ukraine. And you see what happened with the budget now in the Congress in America. And maybe the Russians is a huge, as Napoleon said, don't mess with the Russians. And, the Russians are waiting. They have enough energy to wait until the Ukrainians will say, okay, abandon. We stop.
This is actually also, I think, a very interesting parallel because for many years, the United States, despite claiming neutrality, has been squarely on Israel's side. But more recently, the American support for Israel hasn't been evoked, but it has become less prominent, maybe less forthright. Do you think the same could happen to Ukraine? Because I know you've been a very strong advocate of self-sufficiency when it comes to Israel on defensive manners. Do you think Ukraine has anything
first
to
all,
learn
First
from
of
it?
All, I want to tell you, regarding Israel, I'm an advocate for many years that Israel should not rely on anyone for its defense. Israel should defend itself by itself. We don't need others.
Can you do that without the American support, financial support, and military?
We did it in our independence war, okay, in 48, and we were 600,000 people against a huge military attack on Israel from all the Arab states trying to conquer the small Jewish settlement that were in Israel. I'm sure we can do it because we have behind us 3,000 years of history, and we managed, and we will manage. And I don't know about Ukraine. Ukraine is relying. I just read the numbers: $45 billion of military support from the U.S. through the last couple of years, and this is enormous amount of money. I don't think that Ukraine is going to abandon its what they perceive as their allies, I hope that the NATO is not pushing too much to enter Ukraine into NATO, which will escalate the situation completely into a position, I think, where I will not rule out even the use of nuclear. It's very sensitive. The situation is very sensitive. And I really, we are all people of peace. We all want peace. And I hope that there will be found a peaceful solution for the conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
Well, the difficulty with finding the peaceful solution is that it's not just about the conflict, the interstate conflict between Russia and Ukraine. It's also about, broader architecture in Europe, and I think even globally.
Yes,
absolutely.
The monitoring. look, and we had now discussions about the issue that America has been weaponizing its dollar, making it as a militarizing the economy, and this creates a counter revolution. China, Russia, India, and other, you know, Brazil, South America, South Africa. I'm sorry, to also South America, to create an independent financial framework, not to rely on the dollar and not to rely on. And this, I think, is going to be the reactions for the. And in the end, maybe it's good for the world that we are not, only focusing on American economy, because it's we need some kind of more redundancy in this.
Self-sufficiency or equality.
In Israel, we have learned also from this war, you know, that the health system of Ukraine has been destroyed by the Russians, practically. And you know, this is a scenario that also can happen in Israel by our enemies, and we have to find ways to secure our health system, for example, and lesson learned, to secure our food supply, a lesson learned, and to make sure that Israel is self-sufficient with as much as it can.
Can I ask you one last question? Because Israel also has to think about winning the so-called hearts and minds of the people on the other side. Do you think there's anything that Russia can authentically offer to Ukraine to increase the chances of settling on a national basis and possibly keeping the big American proxy at bay? Is there anything Russia can do?
I would not presume to. It would be presumptuous to me to try to advise the Russian and to.
I'm asking about your opinion.
Yeah, my opinion, but I have to. You know, when I have an opinion, it has to be based on something where I don't feel that my basis is solid enough about the conflict. As I told you, my main concern is about our conflicts and how to manage. For example, I know that it will be very difficult for Israel to win the hearts and minds of the Arabs, okay? The conflict is very, very deep, and which is not very deep in Ukraine, between, you know, most of Ukrainians are Russians, you know.
Well, that's a very, controversial statement.
Am I wrong with the numbers? Or many of the Ukrainians are Russians?
Well, they don't consider themselves Russians.
Anymore.
Absolutely.
But historically, they were Russians.
But historically, I mean, many Arabs lived in the,
yes,
in the
yes.
land of Israel.
But when I'm saying historically, I meant, okay, this is the last, I will exaggerate, 100 years. And while we are with the Arabs, we have a story such, you know. So our conflict is deeper, as I understand it. It's easier to get in terms with the Ukrainians than the Israelis to get in terms with the Arabs.
Well, I hope
not with the Arabs, with the Palestinians, because with the Arabs, as you see, Netanyahu is doing miracles with the Abraham Accord agreements and with the Saudi Arabia. Now, hopefully, we will have peace with Saudi Arabia, and trying to isolate the Palestinian issue with the Arab issue, which is very important for us.
Well, let's hope that both of these conflicts are settled in our lifetimes. Mr. Siboney, it's been a great
pleasure. I just want to make you relax that I don't know if you have kids. Mike, I have kids. I told them, look, you will have enough. Also, your grandchildren will have enough.
Well,
I'm realistic.
I don't know if it's an optimistic or a pessimistic note, but we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us. And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.